So welcome everybody. It's for the benefit of the tape, it's the 26th of April. And I wanted to talk about living in harmony, living in community, I suppose, not particularly all living in the same building as I did when I lived in the Buddhist house, but how do you live with other people and create a harmonious community? And I've sort of got two halves to the talk. The first half, I wanted to say some preliminary remarks about Pure Land Buddhism and how what I'm going to say later fits into Pure Land Buddhism, to sort of to give a greater a sort of context or something to hold the whole thing within. And in the second part of the talk, I want to look at a couple of pieces of advice that the Buddha gave towards the end of his life, about living in community. So in the Pure Land, in this Pure Land school, we have the idea of primary practice and secondary practice. The primary practice is the Nembutsu, calling to Amida, being in relationship to Amida Buddha, experiencing the light of the Buddha washing over us, seeing our own flawed nature in contrast to that. And if that's, Honen says, that's the only practice that you need to do to be born in the Pure Land and then for your ultimate enlightenment. There's something about your relationship with the Buddha that's transformative, whether you do anything else or not. That core practice is enough to take you to enlightenment. We also have the idea of secondary practices and auxiliary faculties. So these are other spiritual practices that you do that help you develop in particular ways. And your secondary faculties might be are the skills that you develop along the way that you can use to bring others to the path, to help other sentient beings. So if you happen to be a good communicator, then maybe you're able to talk about the Dharma in an eloquent way that brings other people to the path. If you're very mindful, other people are influenced by how you are in the world and are, you know, slowly their own selfishness is able to sort of fade away and they go, oh, that person's got something interesting. Not only you learn about yourself, you're also learning about others. So all of these different things that you can develop on top of the foundation of the Nembutsu. And we can think of those secondary practices and the auxiliary practices and the secondary faculties, rather, in terms of the precepts, these lists that we have of things that are good to do, some of which are called precepts and some of which are just lists like the six perfections, which you can think of as precepts. These are good things to cultivate. And in terms of how we work with those kind of virtues or lists from a Pure Land point of view, we can say that the gap between the ideal that the precept describes and how you actually live your life, that gap is the equivalent to a lack of faith in a particular area in your life. If you're a person of complete faith and complete trust, naturally these virtues will spring forth from you and your life will be lived in accordance with the precepts without any problems. It's only when we're defensive in a particular way or we're selfish in a particular way, which is the opposite way of saying a lack of faith, that we don't follow the precepts. So if we feel that we're not at risk, at psychological risk, you could say, or spiritual risk at all, then naturally there's an outflowing of love and wisdom and compassion from us and our actions fall in line with the precepts. But if we, as small human beings, feel that in certain situations we're going to become overwhelmed with emotions or with feelings or with fear that acts as a barrier to us behaving in wise and compassionate ways, from somebody who's very anxious and struggles even to go and speak to a shopkeeper, me when I was a teenager, you know, because of the fear that that is going to all completely become chaotic and you won't know how to handle it, to much more subtle things where we alter the things that we say in conversation to steer the conversation in a way that is comfortable for us rather than perhaps speaking particular truths that would be helpful in that situation, but that we would be afraid would overwhelm us with fear. So to the extent that we're defending ourselves from the fear of being overwhelmed, whether that's the reality or not is a different matter, that's the extent that we don't follow the precepts in our daily life. So when we're completely full of faith in Amida, in the Pure Land, we're following the precepts. And there's two different ways, well, there's lots of different ways, but there's two ways in particular that I wanted to mention with working with this gap between the ideal and the actual. And the reason I'm talking about this is because in a few minutes I'm going to talk about some specific ideals, and I just want to have a framework for us for thinking about how we can work with them. So we can think about the working with them in a positive way, by which I mean if you've got a list of precepts, you can try and consciously behave in the ways that those precepts prescribe. So not taking things that aren't freely offered to you. For a long time when I worked in an office, I noticed that pens would accumulate on my desk without me noticing. It wasn't that other people were coming and leaving pens on my desk, or it wasn't those little pen fairy at night that would go around and bring them all. It was that when I went to other people's desks to ask them a question, without noticing, I would pick up their pen, if I was writing myself a note, and I'd walk away with it. And by the end of the week, I'd have 7 more pens on my desk. And it's still true that most of the pens in this house are in my drawer, in my office, rather than wherever they should be. So that's a gap between the ideal and the actual. You know, it's not a particularly serious offence, but it's taking things that aren't being offered. So one way of me working with that is to think, through the week, I am not going to take any more pens. I'm not going to take anything that's not being offered to me. And really consciously try and do that. And even if I don't have the feeling sense of it being a good thing to do, if I practice the form of it, eventually it starts to sink in. One of two things happen. Either the form of it rubs off and sinks into me and it becomes a natural habit, or it really shows me where my rough edges are, because, you know, my hand shakes when it goes towards the pen and it's really difficult not to pick it up, in which case I know probably there's quite a lot of work to be done in that area. So that's called, colloquially, we sometimes say fake it until you make it, and that's that way of working with the precepts. You behave as if you are already keeping them, and at some point you start to keep them without thinking about it. And the other way is what I've called the more negative way, but it's not really more negative. It's investigating the reason that you don't keep the precepts. So it's being interested in your defensiveness. So what is it about my particular emotional makeup, about my particular character, that gives rise to that particular brand of kleptomania? Is that the right word? Compulsively taking pens from other people's desks. I don't know the answer to that at this moment, but if it was, you know, if working with that precept had showed that it was really difficult for me and my hand really was shaking when I tried to leave other people's pens on their desk, which it doesn't, I'm pleased to say, then there would probably be grounds for sitting and doing some self-analysis, or going and talking to somebody and saying, what is going on? What am I afraid? What's the fear that's operating in that situation? What's the defensiveness? And that's the other way of working with the precepts. What is it that's stopping me from having faith in that moment? And you could say faith in the Buddha, or you could say faith in the fact that it's good to be good. So there's two different ways there. One is fake it till you make it. The other way is really investigating your own human condition. What is it that's really going on in me? Why is there this barrier to me behaving in this way that I know is a good way to behave. Now, both of those things that I've just described are really secondary practices. The Pure Land teaching really says that actually, as you bring yourself closer to the Buddha, as you keep doing your Nembutsu and going back into that relationship with the light, naturally, your faith will begin to increase, even if that's a process that takes many lifetimes. Your lived life will become closer to the precepts the more you bring yourself into relationship with the Buddha. You can see this in if it's a very charismatic person, you know, you see it in some, the sort of ordinary version of this is celebrity culture. When somebody in one direction says that, you know, this brand of, I don't know, clothing is a good brand to buy, suddenly hundreds of thousands, millions of people all over the world start buying that brand of clothing, because that's not their spiritual leader, it's like their worldly leader. And it's the same kind of phenomenon with spiritual practice. The closer you bring yourself to spiritually powerful centres, in this case Amida Buddha, the more you're influenced. And that's what, when we say a Pure Land, what we mean is the field of influence around that Buddha, the area in which that Buddha's charisma, that Buddha's power is operating. And the more you're in that area of power, of charisma, of Pure Land, the more likely you are to be filled up with the Buddha's love and naturally follow the precepts. Having said all of that, those secondary practices that I described, investigating yourself, consciously working with the precepts, they can help move that process along. It's like the Buddha is a good enough dancer that you don't need to have any lessons to go and dance with the Buddha, and he will make you look good. He's that good a dancer. But it doesn't hurt to have some dance lessons, because that will help move the process along. And in fact, you could say even the act of you having dance lessons is inspired by your experience of dancing with the Buddha anyway. So when you're doing the secondary practices in the right spirit, they sort of spring from the Nembutsu naturally. So good to do the Nembutsu, and that's the core practice, but good also to practice your dance steps, to think about working with the precepts consciously and investigating or doing some self-analysis into your own specific bamboo nature. The other thing I wanted to say about the precepts was there's lots of different lists of precepts, some of which were established thousands of years ago. The list of precepts that we use in the Amida Order is much more recent. Any precept, any specific virtue is a particular manifestation of love within a particular context. So the Amitārya precepts in this school of Buddhism, the additional precepts they take to the precepts that Satra and I have taken are about living in community and being free to travel, because that's held as a particular one kind of ideal. It's not to say that keeping those precepts is good for everybody to do, but it's good for that particular group of people to do. So in them, for the circumstances of their lives, the most loving way they can live their lives in the role that they're in is not to be too tied down so that they can come and visit here or the project in India. And that's one particular way that love works itself out in the world. Another way that love works itself out in the world is by somebody making a decision to remain in one place and develop a Pure Land centre locally. Now, those two virtues are at odds with each other, but the spirit of love that's kind of fueling them is the same in each case. So whenever you see a particular list of precepts, I suppose I'm just recommending that you bear in mind that they all come from this spirit of love and compassion, but the wisdom aspect of them, the specific nature of each precept, is dependent on the conditions that they're given in. So when the Buddhist monks were getting assaulted when they went begging after dark, they instigated the idea that they should only beg for food in the morning. Well, in other times, in other cultures, that may not be happening, so maybe we don't need to keep that precept. Or maybe we keep it for different reasons, because it gives us a connection to that particular tradition of monasticism. So although the spirit's the same, the precept can be different in different places at different times. So that's the preliminary remarks. And the reason I wanted to talk about that really was because it's very easy to read, particularly the Pali Canon, which are often lists of good things to do, and think I must work really hard to do those things. And I just wanted to give a sense of how we can approach those kinds of teachings from a Pure Land point of view. So I wanted to talk about living in community, and the couple of lists that I've chosen to talk about are teachings that the Buddha gave towards the end of his life. So he's about 80, he's been teaching for 50 years. He said to Ananda, his personal attendant, "Ananda, you know how when an ox cart is very old, it has to be repaired many times and bits of it have to be strapped up?" He said, "That's how I feel at the moment." So he's coming to the end of his teaching career, and he goes to the Vulture Peak at Rajgriha, which is where the hot springs are, and tradition has it that it's at this time of life when he delivered the Lotus Sutra and the Pure Land Sutra that we've been looking at some Wednesday nights as well. And there's some suggestion that he went there partly to get away from political things that were going in the Ganges Valley. Some of the republics and kingdoms were threatening to go to war with each other. There was some people wanted to get more territory, and actually he wanted to get away from he possibly wanted to get away from that world, but it was impossible. King Ajatasattu sent one of his advisors to speak to the Buddha, and he said, "King Ajatasattu would like some advice. He's thinking of invading the Avajis," name of a particular group of people. "Have you got any advice for him?" Now, the Buddha was sort of put in a difficult position, really, because he relied on the charity of kings in order for his community to thrive and flourish. And he didn't want to say to the king, "Well, actually, you really shouldn't be doing that. It's a bad idea. Particularly, you shouldn't be doing it because the Vajis is the home of your mother, Queen Vaidehi, came from that tribe. So, you know, not only is it politically a bad idea, it's, you know." But on the other hand, he really didn't think it was a good idea. So he thought, "Well, how can I send the right message without being particularly insulting to the king?" So Ananda, his personal assistant, was next to him, and he asked Ananda a series of questions about the Vajis, the people, the Vajis, in order to really give this advice to the king, but in a sly way, in a way that wouldn't seem so offensive. So as well as a great spiritual teacher, he was also a great diplomat. So there's seven questions that the Buddha said to Ananda, and they're framed in the way of, do the Vajis do X, Y, and Z? He said, if they do these things, then I'm sure their country, their republic, their community will continue to flourish for a very long time. And to each of the questions, Ananda says, yes, they do X, Y, and Z. And what is the message he's giving to the king is, because this is a country or a group of people who follow these particular precepts, they're a very strong community, and it's going to be very hard for you to invade and overthrow them because they've got a very strong community spirit. They're not ripe for the taking. And the questions that he asked really describe an ideal community. And he used the same prompts a little while later when he was giving a lecture to the monks and nuns about living in community. So you can see that it sparked off an idea about what are good ways of living in community. And then he mostly used the same list again later on. So I just want to run through the list, really. So the Buddha said to Ananda, do the Vajjis have frequent gatherings, and are their meetings well attended? What I'll do is I'll run through all seven first of all, and then I'll take them one by one and just say a couple of things about them. Do the Vajjis assemble and disperse peacefully and attend to their affairs in concord? Do the Vajjis neither enact new decrees nor abolish existing ones, but proceed in accordance with their ancient constitutions? Do the Vajjis show respect, honour, esteem and veneration towards their elders and think it worthwhile to listen to them? Do the Vajjis refrain from abducting women and maidens of good families and from detaining them? Do the Vajjis show respect, honour, esteem and veneration towards their shrines, both those within the city and outside it, and do not deprive them of the due offerings as given and made to them formerly in the past? Do the Vajjis duly protect and guard the Arahats, so that those who have not come to the realm yet might do so, and those who have already come might live there in peace? Perhaps I'll read the list that he gave to the monks and nuns as well, just so you've got a sense of both the different ones. So he said to the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, the growth of the bhikkhus is to be expected and not their decline, so long as they assemble frequently in large numbers, meet and disperse peacefully and attend to the affairs in the Sangha and concord, appoint no new rules and do not abolish the existing ones, but proceed in accordance with the code of training laid down, show respect, honour, esteem and veneration to the elder bhikkhus, those of long standing, long gone forth, their fathers and leaders of the Sangha, and think it worthwhile to listen to them. Do not come under the power of the craving that leads to fresh becoming, so don't engage in selfishness, essentially. Cherish the forest depths for their dwellings. Establish themselves in mindfulness so that the virtuous brethren of the order who have not come yet might do so, and those who are already here might live in peace. So there's lots of parallels, but there's some slight differences as well. So the first one is, in each of the cases, is do they meet frequently in large numbers? And the tribe, the people that the Buddha came from were, you know, it's often said that the Buddha was a prince, but actually it was probably more a republic. So his father would have been an elder in this tribe of republics, that was a republic. And those elders would meet and make decisions communally. They would listen to each other. There's one description that describes the council as very boisterous, with men poking each other in the meetings. But the Buddha respected this system, and he often, in a couple of other places in the sutras as well, when he's giving advice on how to run a country, he doesn't say one person should be a dictator. He's advocating these kind of councils where people come together and are able to discuss things. So, and we see that in the secular world, he's advocating that kind of system, and also in the Sangha, in the monastic world, do people come together and listen to each other, not only for the purpose of making decisions, but also for sharing what's in their heart, sharing their spiritual experience. You know, the bhikkhus would often travel for much of the year and then come together for the rains retreat, and at that point they would share their experiences with each other. And in the same way, in this community, we go away and do different things, and we come together and listen to each other. And as I said earlier, these precepts, if you like, or lists were given in a particular time and a particular place. But this one, I think, having frequent gatherings that are well attended, listening to each other, taking into account the collective needs rather than one individual's needs, is still a good value for us to uphold today, not only as Amida Buddhists, but also as people in the world. The second one, do people arrive and disperse peacefully? Well, if there's a good feeling in the community, your community is more likely to last than if there's discord in the community. That's fairly self-evident. And things that support harmony are things that are good to cultivate. Things that support discord are things that should be given up. You know, I'm sure, and the first one really is listening to each other, gathering is an example of something that supports harmony. And even as the ways that I spoke about before, faking it till you're making it, and also investigating your own selfishness, those kinds of activities support harmony in the community. So it's about taking care of each other, with each other, particularly when you come into sacred spaces or meetings, and just really considering everybody that's in the room rather than just your own need in each moment. The third one is quite interesting. Do the Sangha or the Vajjis not create new rules, abide by the existing rules, and not abolish any of the existing rules? Now, as an order that has created our own precepts in the last 15 years and changed them in the last, probably about 7 or 8 years ago now was the last time they were changed, we're not abiding by this precept. Why not? Well, because the situation that we live in isn't the same situation that these monks and nuns and people living in the worldly life were living in 2,500 years ago in India. The rules that were appropriate for them to follow, they were following rules that had been established over quite, you know, the Buddha had been teaching for 50 years, so the rules in the Sangha had been built up over trial and error in that time. And he'd seen for the environment and the world that they were living in, that was a good set of things to keep. Particularly when he came to the end of his life, you know, you see him in dialogues with senior monks, and some of the senior monks are saying, you know what, some of these junior monks haven't got the same spirit that we used to have, I'm sure. You know, I don't know whether that's just grumpy old men complaining or whether there really was a sense that in the beginning of the movement there was something really alive and fresh about the Buddha's teaching. 50 years later, people were coming because the Buddha had got thousands of followers by that point, and they maybe not all of the followers were coming to him for completely spiritual reasons, in the way that when the Buddha hadn't got any followers and any lay supporters, you really were putting yourself at the mercy of quite a small group of people in terms of having your alms bowl. But as the Buddha became more and more famous, it was possible for him to go begging and come back with more food than he could eat and more food than he could distribute. People would offer him robes of a really fine quality. So if you didn't want to work and you wanted to receive fine robes and food, you could join the Buddhist Sangha. So maybe there was a bit of degeneration, I don't know. And essentially what the rules were there were as a container for the spirit and to try and encourage people to think about how they behaved. So at that context, at that time, especially given that the Buddha probably knew that he was in his last few months of living, it was probably very good advice to say to people, don't go making up any new rules on a whim. I suppose my advice would be, don't rush to make any new rules and don't rush to break any rules. That's how I would frame it. And in this order, if we want to change any of the precepts, there's quite a long consultation process, which I think is appropriate. Some flexibility is important, but not so much that you change things on a whim, because that's often the result of selfish impulses rather than selfless ones. The fourth condition is about showing respect, honour and esteem towards elders in your community and in the spiritual community, to the fathers and leaders of the Sangha. And we can add to the mothers of the Sangha as well, to the senior nuns and lay women. And I think this is quite interesting. In I don't know if it's here, I was reading a biography of the Buddha recently where it talked about some of the Buddha's esteem for republics. So you can say, on the one hand, if you take that to an extreme, then you maybe end up with a sort of consensus model of governing. And the downside of that model is that nothing gets done because nobody can agree on everything, even when you've all got the same spirit and the same intentions. To actually agree on a set of actions to take or to make decisions about things is very difficult. And if you treat everybody as equally wise when it comes to particular matters, you may end up getting into trouble. If there's a problem with the central heating, I take the advice of my plumber more seriously than I do take the advice of somebody who doesn't know anything about plumbing. And the same should be true in the Sangha. You know, at the other end of the spectrum is this kind of model where one person lays down the law, and there's dangers in that as well. And when we have the first item on this list, frequent meetings and gatherings and listening to each other, and later on honouring and respecting your elders, seems like it's a balance between both of these two things: consulting people, thinking of the group before you think of yourself, but also taking into consideration the advice of people who have been on the spiritual path for a longer time, who are held in high esteem by teachers. Respecting the advice of spiritual plumbers when it comes to spiritual plumbing. And it doesn't say follow everything that your spiritual teacher says without question. It says respect, honour and esteem and venerate your elders. So somewhere in the middle of those two systems. Now then we come to the slightly strange one in terms of the Vajjis. Do they not abduct women and maidens of good families? My guess is that unfortunately this was something that happened in other kingdoms, cultures, countries at that time. And the fact that it wasn't happening in this particular culture showed a particular kind of spirit, I suppose, a particular kind of consideration of other people that meant their community was going to last. You know, don't treat women as objects. We could say don't treat anybody as objects, but particularly bear in mind those groups that have historically been oppressed. And the spiritual version of that in the advice to the bhikkhus is, do not come under the power of craving that leads to fresh becoming. So do not give in to greed that creates ego, or do not give in to your ego when it's expressing greed, which is a sort of more spiritual way of, that's really the spirit. If you like, the one about abducting women is a specific manifestation of greed in the world. So to the monks, he didn't, you know, the monks and nuns weren't going around abducting women, so it probably didn't make much sense to give them that advice. But some of them were still, you know, eating too much chocolate, I guess. Maybe that's just me. And then the advice he gives to the lay people is about respecting their shrines, making offering to their shrines. And this is a practice that he often gave to lay people when they asked for what they should be doing in their spiritual life. It's a practice that cultivates faith, that puts something sacred above your own needs, but it's also a practice that can slot into a lay lifestyle. If you're a merchant or a farmer or a trader, you can make sure that you make appropriate offerings and you can keep the spirit of that alive alongside living your ordinary lay life. The equivalent advice that he gave to the monks and nuns was make time to go into the forest on solitary retreats. Make time to cultivate your inner world as much as your outer world. And both of these pieces of advice are good for us. We live in a spiritual community and we also live in the worldly life. So we should certainly attend to our shrines. And, you know, a lot of the Pure Land practice, the spirit of Pure Land practice, comes out of the advice that the Buddha gave to lay people. I'll maybe come back to that another time when we look at what happened after he died. But in this case, making offerings to shrines, that's the spirit of the Nimbutsu. And that's the practice that he gave to people who didn't have the time or the luxury to go into the forest for months on end, or the spiritual faculties to go into the forest for months on end and meditate. But at the same time, we're lucky enough that we can make space for both of those things, for going on retreat, as well as for living our ordinary lay life. And the final one, in terms of the advice to the lay people, was do the Vajis protect and guard the Arahats? So those people that are spiritually accomplished, are they looked after by the lay community? Because that would encourage more spiritual practitioners to come and dwell in that particular lay community. And if that happens, that would be a benefit for that community. It's good to have people who are experienced in the Dharma living in your city, because you can learn from them, and also because each arahat, even if they're not a fully enlightened Buddha, will have some Buddha field, some arahat field, if you like, around them that begins to transmit the Dharma in the way that I talked about at the beginning. And the advice for the monks and nuns, the equivalent advice for the monks and nuns, is to establish themselves in mindfulness for the same reasons, really. It's like, if you're a lay person, look after people who are established in mindfulness, because they'll be valuable to your community. They'll start to rub off. Well, if you're one of those people, if you're not a lay person, establish yourself in your Buddhist practice. Become mindful of your own selfishness. Become mindful of others' needs. Become mindful of the Buddha. Take care of your own practice, and then in that way you can go into these other communities and be, it's like the bhikkhus in the sense were enzymes. They would go into the communities and things would transform around them. So if you're the enzyme, make sure that you are doing your own practice and staying in relation to your own teachers so that you can perform the function of being an enzyme. And if you're the solution that's going to be transformed, actually bring yourself to the enzyme. Make sure that you're there and present and ready to be transformed, which neatly ties in with what I was saying at the beginning, really. We can be both of these things in our Pure Land practice. We can be the person who goes to the Buddha in order to receive something transformative. And we can also take care of our own practice, follow the precepts, reflect the light that we receive from the Buddha, and be transformative for others. As Dhamma Vijaya says, sometimes we're disciples calling to the Buddha, sometimes we're Buddhas teaching disciples, and sometimes we're Buddhas talking to Buddhas. So we've had a bit about Pure Land practice in the context of thinking about precepts from a Pure Land point of view. We've had a look at some of the particular advice that the Buddha gave to people living in community, either spiritual communities or lay communities. And I should probably stop there in a moment, and we can have some questions and discussion about perhaps how those pieces of advice apply to us living in community in this day and age, and whether there's other things that we can do or things that we would do differently. I've also found seven items from Dhamma Vijaya, which is maybe a modern equivalent of this list. I actually got them three from one place and four from another place. But you can think of this as a parallel list to the lists that I talked about earlier. So the first three are from a chapter called Being a Sangha Member in Not Everything is Impermanent. And the second four are from a chapter called Getting Real as a Sangha. A Sangha member holds practice dear. That's like taking care of your own mindfulness, your own practice. A Sangha member is a disciple. That's the equivalent of venerating your elders. A Sangha member values, celebrates, and contributes to the life of the Sangha. A Sangha member faces up to and admits one's bombu nature and feels the relief in doing so. Starts to think of the collective good rather than individual interest. Takes refuge and does the practice. Namo Amida Buddha.